Morning, Ireland. It's 8:15. 20 months of war on Gaza by Israel. Over 50,000 people dead. Almost everyone in the overcrowded, bombarded, occupied territory displaced. Food, water and medical supplies in very short supply, and no sign of an end or relief. International journalists are not allowed by Israel into Gaza to report. Several local reporters have been killed. And so much of our reporting from Gaza to you has come from people working for aid agencies. James Elder is global spokesperson for UN children's charity UNICEF. He's been to Gaza several times in the last 20 months and has spoken to us from there on many occasions. He's in Ireland this week and we're delighted to welcome him to our studios this morning. James Elder, you're very welcome to Morning Ireland.
Kevin, good morning.
Looked back, this is actually the 10th time we've spoken to you, first time of course in person. On one occasion, I think you were hiding under a table speaking to us because of wherever you were coming under fire at the time. You were in Gaza just over 2 weeks ago. Tell us what you saw.
Yeah, somehow, Gavin, every single time you return to Gaza, you think you've seen the worst and then the next blow hits. And I think for me, the most critical things were, one, seeing this deprivation of water. You mentioned their food. You mentioned the attacks on children. We have not seen levels of water restricted to this point. And like all things in Gaza, this is entirely man-made, entirely political, entirely enforced on a population. So seeing the level of stress that creates in a community, and of course, you know, it's not the most lethal thing for a child is not hunger. The most lethal thing for a child is not a lack of water. It's the deadly collision of these two things on a child's body. So seeing that, without a doubt, seeing these new militarized aid distribution points, it's some of the most horrific stories I can recall recounting, the desperation people are pushed to and then forced into a militarized zone and shot while seeking to stop their families from starving. So somehow, and I know it sounds deathly sad, and Gazans, Palestinians on the ground retain a level of hope and a formidable sense of family and community, but my goodness, you know, the international attention wanes and they've been pushed to an edge that no one's seen for a long time.
We'll talk about those distribution sites in just a moment. You mentioned the lack of water. That's because of a lack of fuel indirectly, isn't it?
Yes, exactly, Gavin. So essentially, water comes into Gaza in two ways. One is pipelines, and Israel control those, and they turn the tap on and off. And the other used to be electricity, which would run desalination plants. Electricity is completely...
Taking water from the sea.
Exactly. And it's extraordinary what it does. And it speaks to the literacy rates in Gaza, that one of the reasons that Gaza keeps bouncing back after all these horrific things is because Palestinians have one of the highest literacy rates on the planet. So those desalination plants are on the back of, you know, the engineering computer sense of local people. But because electricity has been turned off, you need fuel. You need fuel to run the plants. You need fuel to distribute water. And we've had a 100-day blockade of fuel. So that is now, you know, you can talk backwards and forwards about blocking food because Hamas steals it. It's simply, there's no evidence base to that. It's very, very important. It's a population being starved. Water goes straight to a population. So again, there is no rhyme nor reason, no evidence nor logic for that. 100-day blockade, Gavin, of fuel means that people are within weeks of seeing children die of thirst. Fuel, of course, also means ambulances run. It means incubators run. It means hospital generators run. 100-day blockade on any fuel coming into Gaza, for me, was one of the darkest testimonies to the intent of what we're seeing in Gaza.
Much of your work is work with children. Can you tell us the story of Abed al-Rahman, just by way of illustration of what many children are going through in Gaza at the moment?
Yeah, it's very important because it speaks to there are new distribution sites set up, but they're militarized, Gavin. So the United Nations, during the ceasefire, let's go back a step, you know, UNICEF and partners, we had 400 distribution points across Gaza. That's humanitarianism. You go to where people need help. You're aware of mums. You're aware of children whose dads have been killed. You're aware of the elderly. And we saw on that, you know, good humanitarianism is about following data, following evidence, malnutrition dropping. UNICEF went door to door with therapeutic food. Since the end of the ceasefire, there's been, again, a virtual blockade, and Israel has put in four militarized aid distribution points. So imagine all of Dublin was under a siege, and then you've got four sites now in City West, and that's the only four sites you can get food, and only food. So this little boy you mentioned, Abed al-Rahman, I met him. He was given money by his dad to go and get bread. That was the money they had. He went on the streets. He saw people heading to one of these sites, and he thought, well, this is my moment. I've seen the pain of my mum. I've seen my mum starving. I'm going to get them a proper box of food. He went there, corralled into these cages, as people are. I've heard this story dozens of times, Gavin. Suddenly there was a drone shooting overhead. He ran. Next thing, there was a tank shell. He got shrapnel from the tank shell in his body. When I met this little boy, the despair of his mum, he told me his story. His dad, you know, it's a patriarchal society, Gavin. His dad's in tears because he's listening to his boy explain, I just wanted to help my family. This little guy sat up and held my arm as he told his story for social media to try and get him a medical evacuation, just as he wanted to help his family to these sites. And on the day I left Gaza, he died. That's what humanitarian aid risk being turned into. And you hear the annoyance in my voice, not just because of this little boy, because if this is normalised, then you have war zones around the world where warring parties get to choose who brings aid in and who doesn't.
The BBC are reporting this morning with accounts from an anonymous security worker who worked at all four of those GHF sites, that he saw colleagues fire on hungry people who posed no threat and described a culture of impunity with few controls. Let's just hear a little of it.
If there's anything that you feel uncomfortable with, shoot and ask questions later. If you feel threatened, shoot to kill and ask questions later. That's a direct quote. And he even gave us like a physical demonstration of like, hey, if we're out on a site and you see someone with a gun, that's a threat. Take them out. If we're on a site and somebody, you know, is any way aggressive towards you, take them out. That's a threat. And that's just, that is legally, ethically, and morally unequivocally untrue.
That's the account of one whistleblower speaking on condition of anonymity. In response, the GHF told the BBC that these claims were categorically false. James Elder from UNICEF, still in our studio. Have you been to these distribution sites?
No, it's a great irony, Gavin, because it's a militarised site. So anywhere we move in the Gaza Strip must be deconflicted. That's how people access it. That's how they access these sites safely. So whilst we've seen now more than 15 mass casualty events, whilst people are being starved and then scrambling to survive, and you hear that testimony, and we've heard that as well off the record from soldiers as well. No, we can't access them because we distribute aid when we do it, and we still do it all the time, but you have to have a deconflicted site, which was one of the great concerns with this. You cannot force people through a militarized zone and then have a justification for them being shot because they're in a militarized zone. So when these horrific events going on, UNICEF is still handing out therapeutic food, doing our distributions, and no one is being shot. No one is being killed, whether it's in Sudan, Ethiopia, or Gaza. I've seen them. I can see from a distance, Gavin. Every morning I would watch and I would see thousands of men, almost always men, some children, coming from these sites. One in 15 people would have something. But listening to that testimony, I mean, I was in contact with someone this morning who explained the story of a father. He had two children die of malnutrition. He was 25 miles. Again, it's this idea of you've got to get to City West because there's nothing near you. And he walked 25 miles. He was so terrified he would lose his other two children. He'd lost two boys. He walked 25 miles. He stayed a night. He was unsuccessful. He stayed another night. He was shot and he made his way back. It took him 2 days. So he returned with no food for his surviving two children. These are not unique stories. These are stories we hear time and again. I heard dozens of these stories when I was seeing families in Gaza, talking to them about UNICEF cash distribution or water or nutrition, just going around seeing the impact of our work, but hearing the horrifying stories of people who, you know, are in tears because, as an old woman said, James, how do I possibly get food from these sites?
What's going to happen to Gaza ultimately, in your view?
Part of me has this immense hope, Gavin, because I have not seen the literacy rate, as I say, 98% literacy rate. You're in a place where Palestinians have endured so much, as the Irish people know, for so many decades. Parents and grandparents do everything in their power to keep those kids in school. UNICEF does the same in our education work, in our trauma work. So there is a reason why Palestinian graduates from Gaza are the envy of universities around the region. So there is that. And I heard in the ceasefire, I thought people were joking with me, Gavin. They said a day one of the ceasefire, people were having cappuccinos and cake. There is an ability of that place to bounce back. And it's not a cliche. It's because of what they've been through. And yet, we are in uncharted territory when it comes to trauma. Every single child in Gaza needs mental health support. And as child psychologists said to me, we don't call it PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, because there's no post. Trauma's intersecting all the time. So we cannot even begin to address that. So I think we're at a point where it's overdue, so overdue, the international community needs to act. And you and I have spoken on many, many aspects here. One thing I haven't mentioned still is that 17,000 girls and boys have been reportedly killed. That's a girl or a boy killed every single hour since October 7. Now, when that is no longer reported, that's not a failure in journalism. That's a failure of humanity, of the international community. So until we see a sustained ceasefire, then, and we've seen many false hopes, I have to paraphrase those people I meet in Gaza, Gavin, and to which a fifth-year medical student said to me, it's very dangerous to dream in Gaza.
Before we let you go, and I'm sure we will speak to you again from Gaza, are you okay with all that you've seen and heard over the last 20 months?
I mean, I think it feels indulgent to think how I am because I get to leave Gaza. There are things I have seen or smelt that I would, you know, will not leave me, and I wish I hadn't. But I'm also privileged because I do see the impact of a mum when she gets that therapeutic food. I have met Palestinians whose stories and values I just am overwhelmed by. So there is a great gift I get to meeting those people. But yes, for so many reasons, I mostly for Palestinians, I want this over.
James Elder, global spokesperson for UNICEF. Thank you very much for coming into us this morning. 26 minutes past 8.